Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here again. Welcome to our every other week bi-weekly teleconference. We're fresh back from our first definitive board prep course of the year. We were in Los Angeles last week. Those of you who attended, thank you so much for joining us. We had, it was just so so rewarding because people came up to us, so many, and said how much they enjoyed it and how great it was. And yeah, I am giving a bit of a plug here, but it's true. Everyone really felt it was so helpful. They appreciated how much we really want to be there for you folks. And I'm repeating that here. We really want to be there for you folks so that if you have any questions regarding anything relating to this exam, I really want you to feel that Exam Pro is there. We should be your first place to go to. Give us a call. Your call, if it can't be handled by my staff, will be passed on to me or my faculty. But please don't be shy. Let us be there to help you folks. It really, we feel very passionate that you folks should have the easiest ride as possible in the exam. And obviously, more importantly, that you should be successful in the exam. So with that out the way, like I start every teleseminar, we always have new people joining us. So today we've got only one candidate who has a baby in the background. And what we do is we've got one candidate who has submitted a case for us to discuss. And I encourage you to do this. It's an opportunity to have your questions answered, to be able to explain your decision-making, which is really very important. And it's done in a friendly, comfortable manner. And that's how we do this. So let's get straight on with it. I've got a bit of a problem because I've got the name of the candidate who submitted the issue. I only have the last name, and I don't want to mention any last name. So I'm going to spell the first four letters of the last name. And if that's you, can you please just give me your first name, because I'd rather refer to you by your first name and keep you anonymous. So, and whoever it is, can I ask you please to keep the background noise to a minimum, because it affects everyone. So I'm sorry. If you can please go to another room, or perhaps try and sort things out amicably. The first four letters of the last name is R, R-E-Y-N. If that's you, R-E-Y-N, can you shout out your first name?
Hi, my first name is Reynolds.
Okay, your first name is Reynolds. I thought it was the last name. My apologies. Reynolds, can I ask you, is that, are those kids in your coming through your phone?
They are in my car. I do not have a way to remove
them. Oh, my goodness. Okay, that's a tough one. All right, look, you're doing the best you can. Reynolds, you've presented a very unusual case, but it brings up one or two really important issues, which is really what I want to concentrate on, because that's relevant for you and everyone listening in. So in a nutshell, can you, now you're driving, I don't want to compromise your driving. Are you comfortable that you can just briefly present the case to us or not?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I have a 16-year-old female, nulla gravida, who presents with primary dysmenorrhea, heavy menstrual bleeding of irregular frequency. She has other symptoms, other clinical symptoms, which are suggestive of endometriosis. She is virginal, so she does not have any dyspareunia. She's also affected significantly by premenstrual dysphoric disorder with catastrophication leading up to her menses. So she has extreme anxiety on top of the mood changes from expecting her menstrual cycle. She's had radiology in the past, which was all normal.
So I'm going to add something, because I'm seeing what you wrote down. Everyone listening in, Reynolds submitted the actual case as it appears in his case list. And let me just add some things based on what he said. He said, yes, she had some normal radiological testing. In 2 years ago, she had multiple CTs of the abdomen, pelvis, all were normal during emergency department visits. And she also had multiple ultrasounds of the abdomen and pelvis, all were normal. I think it's important to add that because it speaks to the fact that this is not just a simple dysmenorrhea. I mean, she's got dysphoric disorder, and it's taken her to the OR, plural, many times, and she's had, you know, if they're going to order CT scans, multiple, this is not simple, everyday case of primary dysmenorrhea and premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's a major issue, and so that's why I'm giving a little bit of oral exam technique now, Reynolds. I think this is something that you should give over verbally. It emphasizes the issue, okay? All right, carry on with your presentation.
So she presented to clinic with her mother as her chaperone, seeking for management of her pain symptoms and bleeding symptoms as a primary concern, but also interested in management for her mood symptoms leading up to her menstrual cycle.
Okay.
I'm on the phone. Sorry.
Say that last bit again. Sorry, I missed it.
So her primary concern was for managing her menstrual symptoms and heavy bleeding, with a secondary concern of wishing to manage the mood symptoms leading up to her painful period.
Okay. And folks listening in, it's in the category pediatric and adolescent patients, correct, Reynolds?
Sorry, what was that?
It's in the category of pediatric and adolescent GYN.
Yes.
Okay. So, I'm going to take this from a general point of view. And Reynolds, I'm going to be totally honest with you. My comfort level with talking about psychiatric and psychological GYN issues, I'm honest, I'm not comfortable. It's not a hot topic of mine. And I'm not comfortable to give you a definitive answer on what is the correct management. I would say it is an important subject. I'm the first to admit it. And ABOG has had in the last year or two articles on mental or dysphoric disorder, as well as ACOG has had various publications on this matter. So it's not an irrelevant subject. But the point that I want to drive home with this case, and this is for you, Reynolds, as well as everyone listening in. If you've got a case where it's not, you don't have an intrinsic comfort level with the subject, at a bare minimum, be able to say just one or two sentences on what your initial approach may be. And as long as we're not talking about something like preeclampsia, okay, or fibroids, it's okay once you've done the initial assessment and the first attempt at management, it's okay to refer the patient to someone who knows more. With fibroids, obviously, we're expected to deal with it regardless. But something like this, this is a very severe case. And if this is not dealt with as a 16-year-old girl, this can affect her sexually, socially, maritally for the rest of her life. It's really a big deal, and it's serious. So it's quite acceptable to say, you know, I made the initial assessment. This is my understanding of how these patients are treated. I tried the following, which is the first line of treatment, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But when I got no resolution, I felt, given the severity of the case, it was appropriate that she'd be managed by someone who has a better insight than I, and I referred her to whoever. So my question to you, Reynolds, did you actually refer her? Did she respond to treatment? What actually transpired?
Excellent. So my first initial approach to choosing this question was I did want to use up both my pediatric gynecological subjects because I'm not super comfortable with a lot of things outside of that area. So I kind of wanted to use these.
Oh, is this your baby, so to speak? You, this is your specific interest? Pediatric adolescent GYN?
No, but I'm in the middle of nowhere, so we kind of have to deal with everything.
Okay, okay.
So
that's fine. You know, those of you that came to our course last week, you heard me say this multiple times, and I say it to you, Reynolds, and to everyone, just be open and honest. It's okay to say, you know, if I, and just by the way, I think it's nice to say somehow that you're working in an underserved area, which is what I assume is your case. Because if for example, you're working in Manhattan and you decide to move and leave and go somewhere else, no one's going to know the difference. Your absence won't be noticed at all. But Reynolds, if you leave your area, you are really a key member of society. They need you badly. And if you left, they would notice big time. So it's to your credit that you're working there. And I would argue at a subconscious level, if the examiner understands this is your circumstance, they're going to want to get you, keep you there working because you're doing incredible work. So it's a feather in your cap. And I think subconsciously, it works to your benefit in the exam. So based on what you're saying, I would say, you know, and I'm working in a very underserved area, and as such, I don't have the luxury of being able to refer these kind of patients when I would like to. So what I did in this case was, presented with this presentation, I started her on the birth control pills. No, she had birth control pills. Then you gave her NSAIDs and tranexamic acid. Did that work? Or were you still at a loss at that point? So you've given her two types of treatment. Did that help or no?
Excellent question. I cycled her through several different types of birth control. The first form of birth control was a monthly.
Okay, I'm not gonna, it's not important for here and now to go into the details. But folks, the discussion I'm having with Reynolds really is relevant to every one of you, okay? Not in this particular context, but in general principle. It's great that you tried different kinds of birth control pills. And I don't want you to spend too much time going through each of the seven types that you tried. I do think you can say, you know, I tried multiple different kinds. I switched and changed. I probably tried six or seven different kinds of birth control pills over X month time period. The one thing you must be able to do, any of you who have a situation like this, you must be able to describe what was your thinking as you, switched from a combined to a progesterone-only containing birth control pill, just as an example. You've got to give a reason for it. And as long as you can give any reasonable reason, that's fine. You're good. So you say you've tried seven times. I think not the authority on this.
Several.
Several, okay. Because I would say after the third dose, or the third a birth control pill, I would pretty much give up my hands, throw my hands up in the air, say, this is not working. So you tried, let's say, three different kinds. Make sure you can give the reason why you switch from one to the other. And that's for all of you folks. When you switch from one treatment to another, explain why the difference. You know where this often comes up is when you're treating an infection and you get a switch, you get a culture sensitivity back, you switch from one antibiotic to another. Make sure you can explain what prompted the switch. So you tried several different kinds of contraception. I'm assuming it didn't work. Is that correct?
It actually did start working on the third birth control tablet.
Okay, that's excellent. I'm going to play the devil's advocate, which the examiner may do with you folks. And just for the, and they're playing with you almost. They may say, because you, if you've tried three different kinds and finally it's worked, that's success. That's fantastic. They may say, what would you have done if you hadn't had success? They may push you to the wall. Are there any other options open to you? And at the end of the day, it's okay, Reynolds, to say, you know, if this didn't work, I would have gotten to the end of my armamentarium of options. And as difficult as it is for my patients to go elsewhere, because it means a whole day travel, I'm in an underserved area once again, if I feel it's in the patient's best interest, absolutely I will do that. So you've always got a release valve. That's the point I want to make. Now, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so I've purposely shied away from the treatment of premenstrual dysphoric disorder and primary dysmenorrhea. That, you know, you can read that up. That's not a problem. There's one other thing I want to mention to all of you. Probably about 70%, 75% of you, and I know this because I've reviewed hundreds of case lists over the years. This is case list season, as you can understand. We're in the thick of it. In fact, just by the way, if you're considering having Exampro do a case list for you, you want to, A, get the list to us as soon as possible, but more importantly, you want to register with us immediately, because we're rapidly approaching the point where we are probably going to have to turn around to people and say, we can't accept any more. Our faculty are working around the clock because there's such a pressure at this time of the year. So, I'd love every one of you to do a case list review with us. That's not the argument I'm making. I'm saying, if you're planning on doing a case list review with us and you have not yet registered for it, register immediately and go online or phone the office and do it immediately. And if you miss them today, they are open until I think it was still 5 p.m. Eastern, so they would be closed now. But either do it online today or first thing tomorrow. But because we often do, and this year in particular, we probably will get saturated and will not be able to accept at some point. So that being said, I got off at a tangent. About 75% of you also have cases in your office section in the pediatrics and adolescent GYN section, a category. There are some classical questions that you got to know. And even if a guy like Reynolds has a patient in this category on premenstrual dysphoric disorder, they can also always move on to the next issue. And you've got to be comfortable to discuss the following two things. Number one, what is the ideal age for a patient, a young girl, to come to the GYN for her first visit? That's number one. Number two, what is the purpose of that first visit? What do we do at that first visit? And it includes things like establishing a relationship, teaching the patient about GYN health and periods and physiology, etc. And then the third question is, does one do a digital exam? Obviously, that would not be the correct thing to do. But what tests can one do, and when does one do tests for sexually transmitted diseases? So just be ready for those three or four questions. If you've got any case in the pediatric and adolescent GYN category. All right, Reynolds, are you okay with that case? You know how to go about handling it?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Excellent. Good. I'm pleased. The next question is, it's not a case, but was it you who wrote in your email, I watched the cases preparation course through Xampa, but I had a question regarding OB cases. Was that you or was it someone else?
I did ask a question about midwife cases.
Yes, okay. So go ahead. So it's you. Go ahead and repeat your question to me.
Our office or our practice has a large midwife group that manages probably 60% of our patients. Our computer system admits every midwife patient under the physician's name, even if we never see them. Do I need to list those cases because I am listed on each of their charts?
Okay, I believe this was relatively recently addressed in an ABOG bulletin, and if it's a straightforward, normal antepartum, intrapartum, and postpartum experience, then even if you didn't manage the patient, you wouldn't have to list it. It's a normal case. Now, the vast majority of midwife cases, excuse me, the vast majority of midwife cases are pretty normal and standard. So if there's a complication of significance, and here you need to use your judgment, you need to put that down. Because at the end of the day, your name is going down as the OBGYN of record, and you're covering the midwife. So you are ultimately responsible. So if there's a major complication, I would put that down. Now, there's another issue. This year is the first year that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Reynolds, this is the first year that ABOG has said you do not need to get your medical records department to sign an affidavit sheet. Is that your understanding, Reynolds?
I was unaware of that, but that's awesome.
Yeah, so look, if I'm saying the wrong thing, I would ask you folks to check up on the bulletin. We discussed this last week, but I believe that's the case. So if there's any question, please, every one of you, I hate to do this, just send an email to ABOG, and I'm almost certain they're going to confirm that for you. You might even see it. You probably will see it if you look online in the ABOG bulletin. Okay? I understand that, and it's never been like this before. You do not need to submit an affidavit, but if for whatever reason, just at their merest whim, ABOC desires or feels a need, or just it's that day of the week, they decide they want a medical records to verify your case list, then you've got to go ahead and do that. So, and when you sign into the exam, you've got to sign a piece of paper which says that you're not going to share any information with anyone, and that if asked to by ABOC, you will submit an affidavit from medical records. You will assist them to verify your patients. So that's an FYI. That being said, if you're one of the few percent whom they call upon to verify, and in the past I heard that they reviewed, this is 20 years ago, I know a candidate who was told that they reviewed by ABOG, that at that point they used to review about 10% of medical record submissions. That doesn't mean to say they reviewed the details of every case. I believe it's they review that the cases you say you've done, you did actually do. That's all, that you didn't leave any out. So you might want to, A, confirm this with ABOG, and B, if you're in the situation, you can either just wait and see if they ask you for a verification, but probably we're all type A personality. If you're in the situation and the bulk of your cases are actually managed by the midwife, it makes a substantial difference in terms of numbers and entries into your cases. If the midwives have done only 5 cases and you've got 70 cases on your list, it's not as much of an issue. But Reynolds said that 60% of his cases were done by a midwife. So it may well be an issue. And so therefore, Reynolds, I would advise you openly and honestly to put this in an email to ABOG. It's not going to red flag you. They're not going to think anything less of you. Your examiners won't even know that you had this question. And you will get your answer probably within 20 minutes. They're really very good about this, but certainly within 24 hours. Then you've got a paper trail, and you just do whatever they recommend. So my gut is, of the 60%, there are a few patients who had significant issues. And if that's the case, I definitely would put those in. And the question is, should you put in the others? My recommendation to you is you probably don't have to do that, but equally I would recommend you just clarify that with ABOG.
Okay.
So does that answer that question, Reynolds?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. And then you had another question. If I admit, I'm just reading what you wrote, if I admit a patient to the antepartum service, for example, as hyperemesis, that's an OB case, but I don't deliver them. So do they get listed? So let me answer your question this way. Any non-delivered OB admission, so hyperemesis would be one. Third trimester bleeding would be another. I can't think of another one offhand. If you have any of these cases, a UTI in pregnancy might be another one. A pyelonephritis in pregnancy. So if you've got these kind of cases, 95% of the management occurs when the patient is admitted and you write up the H&P and you write in the orders. So if you did admit a patient for a non-deliverable admission, then yes, you need to put that patient down. And similarly, on the GYN side, in fact, you actually write here, your next question is, similarly, if I'm admitting gynecology, if I am the admitting gynecology physician, but the patient goes to the OR with a different physician, do I put that patient down on my list? So it's a little different to the point I was going to make. I'm going to come back to your sentence. But in the OB side, if you admit a non-deliverable admission, she should go down. On the GYN side, if it's not quite your question, if you admit a non-operative admission, so maybe you do methotrexate as an inpatient, you've got a PID or a TOA that's treated medically, it's the same argument. 95% of the work and management is done by the admitting physician. So yes, I would put that case down. Now, the question that you ask is a little different. You admitted a patient, but she went to the OR with a different physician. That's not a non-operative admission. That's an operative admission. So in that context, the person, if you and the guy that did the surgery were both taking the exam, I would tell you that you don't need to put the patient on your list, but the person who does the surgery does. So I answered your question, and I gave you a different caveat as well. And it's important for everyone listening in, obviously, as well. So Reynolds, again, did I answer your questions?
Fantastically.
All right, perfect. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right, folks, we only have one person who submitted a case today, so it's a little short. And so I don't have much more to share with you, except there's one important thing I do want to share before we sign off. I've been involved with the MOC process since 2008, which is when they instituted it for everyone. I mean, examiners had an option to do this, but in 2008, it became necessary for all board-certified OBGYNs to maintain their certification. And for the first time that I am aware of, they finished issuing their, whatever it is, 30 articles, which you have to read, and I'm sure you folks are aware of it. And they issued that list at the end of May. And by the way, the articles are generally very good articles, and certainly if you've got a case on your case list in which any of these articles are relevant, it's not a bad idea to be familiar with it. Those of you who sign up for our Definitive Board Prep course, by the way, you may have already received that list of articles, so you can go through it. And I will talk a little bit, just briefly, about the MSC and these articles with you when you attend the course. But the point that I want to make is this year, for the very first time, after they had submitted the entire list of the entire list of articles, they issued about a week ago, it was brought to my attention just on Thursday last week, they issued an additional article as ongoing continuing medical education. And they obviously felt this was important, and it's the first time they've ever done it. What's the title of the article? It appeared in Clinical OBGYN. I think that's where it came from. Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology. The title, The Return of an Old Foe, Syphilis Among Women. And it's a summary or review article on syphilis. I'm actually halfway through reading this article and summarizing it. Syphilis, first of all, some of you, and maybe 5-10% maximum, have syphilis on your case list. If you've got syphilis on your case list, you really have to know this article because it's really important. Now, when I say you have to know this article, it doesn't have to be this article, although it's a good read so far, but you need to be comfortable with the conversation on syphilis. It's a great, magnificent exam question, so please know it well. If you don't have syphilis on your case list, given the fact that they issued this additional article, I think it's not a bad idea that all of you, not even if you don't have a case on your case list, you don't have to be ready for a full-blown conversation because it's not on your case list, but at least be able to say two or three sentences on syphilis. Don't be left short. If they felt it was that critical that they needed to issue another article, even after they had finished issuing all the articles for the year, that speaks volumes. So all I'm saying to you is syphilis for 2025 candidates is important, and I'd ask you to keep that in mind. Okay, so that's that. The last state issue I want to bring to your attention is our next teleseminar will be in 2 weeks, as it usually is. So we're going to do this again on the 3rd of August. That's a Sunday, 2 weeks from today, 3rd of August. So with that being said, very briefly, Reynolds, honest truth, did you find this to be helpful?
I did. Thank you very much. And if we're looking for more to talk about, I'd be happy to go into the premenstrual dysphoric disorder component of the case if we want to go a little longer.
So I'm going to be honest. I bypassed it. I'm not comfortable to have that conversation. I'm not comfortable in my knowledge of it, and I'm just being honest with you folks. I hope you're not upset or offended with me by that. But I'm being honest. I'm not comfortable to discuss premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And so I'm actually leaving it to you just to learn the basics of it. Okay? I apologize for that, but I don't want to give you bad information. That's the context in which I'm sharing this with you. Okay?
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all the info.
Okay, sure. So, folks, all I'm saying is you notice I never mentioned his last name. He remains anonymous. He did a good job, by the way. And I want to encourage all of you to volunteer. It really, it's good practice for the exam. I can't emphasize that enough. And the last thing I will say, Reynolds gets the prize for being able to double task. Driving, looking after some crying kids, and being able to concentrate on presenting a case. So well done, Reynolds. I know that wasn't easy. All right, folks, that's it for today. You're welcome. We'll do this again in two weeks. Thank you so much to everyone. And by the way, we're doing our next Definitive Board Prep course. We'll be in 3 weeks in Baltimore and then in 5 weeks in Los Angeles, something like that. So if you're interested, that's our next two. We've got three more in total. And then we're done for the year. It's happening very quickly this year. All right, folks, that's it. I hope you found this helpful. We'll do this again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, Reynolds, and this then concludes our teleseminar. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.